Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Shechtman. 48 years ago, we were in the midst of another presidential campaign. Not unlike the one we are in now, many felt it was a very seminal moment in American history. JFK and Martin Luther King had been assassinated. The Vietnam War was escalating. Race riots were becoming a fact of urban life. Racial and generational politics and social issues were tearing the country apart. Richard Nixon represented what he perceived as the silent majority, and Hubert Humphrey represented the Democratic establishment. And Bobby Kennedy had parachuted in to replace Gene McCarthy as the great white hope of stitching the country back together. Then on the night of June 5th, 1968, after winning the all-important California primary, Bobby was assassinated. Last week, his alleged assassin, Sirhan Sirhan, was once again up for his 14th parole hearing. Attending were some of Bobby's closest confidants who still believe that Sirhan was not the single shooter and not the one who fired the shot that took Bobby Kennedy's life. My guest today on Who, What, Why is author and filmmaker Shane O'Sullivan. He spent years researching Bobby Kennedy's death. He's the author of the book Who Killed Bobby and the film RFK Must Die. It is my pleasure to welcome Shane O'Sullivan to the program. Shane, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Pleasure to speak to you, Jeff.
It's great to have you here. What was it originally that drew you into this story, Shane, many years ago?
Yeah, I first got involved about 12 years or so ago. Even though I'm from Ireland, I didn't know the Kennedy assassination stories that well. But my wife was researching a program on Kennedy conspiracy theories for Japanese television, believe it or not. And that's when I first heard about Sirhan Sirhan and some of the mysteries around the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. And in researching that, originally I was working as a screenplay writer and thought it would make a fantastic adapted screenplay. But the more I researched it and the more I tried to find out what was the ending to the story, that kind of led to my own research and led it to me towards making the documentary RFK Must Die.
And as you dug into making the documentary and began to examine the ballistic evidence, what had happened with the LAPD and the LA District Attorney's Office, talk about what moved you from thinking that this was more than another conspiracy story to really something where the facts had just not come out in this case.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, you know, first of all, that the time lapse between the assassination itself and the release of all the police investigation files is what's kind of hampered the reopening of the case in a way, because it took 20 years of kind of provocation and protest by Paul Schrades, the guy who was in the news this week, and he was shot in the head on the night of the assassination. He's been basically leading the campaign to reopen the case for over 40 years, and one of the things that he was able to do is get the LAPD to release the files in 1988. And what they show is that, you know, Sirhan, according to all the witness testimony that was gathered by the police at the time and the FBI, all of the witness statements put the barrel of Sirhan's gun 2 to 6 feet in front of Kennedy, whereas the autopsy clearly states that the fatal shot was fired from 1 inch behind Kennedy's right ear. So that sets up, you know, one of the key aspects of the case in terms of two potential firing positions: Sirhan in front of Kennedy, several feet in front. Several of the witnesses who were actually trying to restrain Sirhan said his gun was never in the position described in the autopsy, an inch behind Kennedy's right ear. And then you have the person who was actually behind Kennedy and possibly in a position to fire the shot, who was a part-time security guard called Payne Eugene Caesar, who was the subject of a feature documentary in the early 70s that introduced the kind of second gun theory to the case. And, you know, he was interviewed for this film called The Second Gun by Ted Chirac, and he was very right-wing. He was very against Kennedy, and, you know, he seemed kind of amused looking back at the whole assassination and his place in it. I guess a lot of these things kind of got my interest, as well as the kind of mystery around Sirhan's recall of the shooting. He has no memory of the shooting itself. All he remembers consistently over the years is being led into a dark place by a girl who wanted coffee. he later found out that this dark place was the pantry, and he has really no memory, or kind of a blackout in his memory, between that point where he went into the dark place with the girl who wanted coffee and he was being choked on the steam table after the first round of shots had gone off from his gun. And he's been very consistent with that for nearly 48 years. I can see no reason why he would lie about it, because in a sense it's hampering his case and hampering his chance of parole. Because if he, you know, if he did remember and he did recall, he could make a full confession and he would easier meet the parole criteria. But as it is, because he can't recall, and because this has been verified by the psychologists who work with him over the years, it sets up a kind of catch-22 situation, because how do you express full remorse, or how do you express full insight into your crime if you can't actually remember committing it, which really goes to the core of what he's been struggling with in the parole process last week.
What have psychologists said with respect to this repressed memory? That could it have been from the trauma of the event, the way the event went down, or is it the assumption been that there is something else that has prevented his recall?
Well, I mean, you know, we know much better today than we knew, you know, I guess 48 years ago, that trauma obviously can play a part in that. And, you know, that may be one thing to attribute it to. But I think that the psychologists and psychiatrists who worked with him in most detail are kind of convinced that he was in a hypnotic state on the night of the shooting and during the shooting itself. Now, that may sound very far-fetched, but back at the time, Sirhan was very much into mysticism and self-hypnosis. And he would spend a lot of the time in his room hypnotizing himself in front of a mirror and hypnotizing himself in the mirror, and then writing out various phrases in his notebook as a means of thought control or mind control. And so the theory was, back at his trial by the defense psychiatrist, Dr. Bernard Diamond, that the mirrors along the hallways in the Wasser Hotel had somehow triggered him into this trance, and he had acted out some of the writings in his notebook, which state RFK must die, RFK must die, repeatedly. And he had kind of gone into that trance state and kind of reenacted some of these writings in real life then in the pantry when he saw Bobby Kennedy. So the theory was that he'd almost hypnotized himself to kill Bobby Kennedy, and the motivation for that would be that Kennedy had agreed or had pledged during his campaign to sell 50 bombers to Israel if he had been elected to the White House, to replenish bombers that were lost in the 60 war the year before. And so that was the kind of post-rationalization that the defense came up with at the trial. It was kind of laughed out of court at the time because it seemed so far-fetched, and there was nothing on the record to indicate that hypnosis had ever played a role in this kind of assassination. But we know a lot more later on in the 70s, when congressional hearings established that the CIA and other agencies were trying to do just that in the 50s, to create a programmed, hypno-programmed assassin who could be programmed to assassinate various figures and have no memory of actually having done it. So I think, you know, after the trial, some of the psychiatrists who looked at Sirhan were more aware of that context, and I guess later on saw him as the closest we have to a real-life Manchurian candidate in terms of some of these ideas of what the CIA were trying to do in the 50s, and how either CIA or other kind of rogue individuals may have got to Sirhan in advance of the assassination.
Is there any evidence that has come out as to who Sirhan may have had contact with that might have somehow been responsible, or directly or indirectly responsible, for any kind of hypnosis and or programming?
I think that's the gap at the moment. You know, we don't know who it was. We know that he was away from home. He wasn't away from home for any length of time in the months leading up to the assassination, but he was for several months away from home at a ranch when he was trying to establish himself as a jockey 2 years before the assassination. He had a fall from a horse, which you know, according to the medical records, he only was, you know, had a brief stay in the hospital, and he had some minor eye damage, and apparently he was fine. But according to his mother and his best friend, he went missing for 2 weeks. So I think Dr. Daniel Brown, who's worked for Sirhan over the last 5 years to try and help him with his recall of his memory and trying to piece together if there is such a context for people working with him to program him for the assassination, they suspected that that experience 2 years beforehand may have been the start of that process, but they haven't really been able to nail it down in any kind of formal way. I think that the strongest evidence we have that there may have been others involved in terms of this kind of hypnotic conditioning is the fact that Sirhan, in the last 5 years, and during his work with Dr. Daniel Brown from Harvard Medical School, at least three times during their sessions together, when he's been put in a hypnotic trance, he's kind of reenacted the range mode of basically being in a hypnotic trance, seeing firing targets in front of his eyes, and then taking a firing position and shooting. So he's actually reenacted the possible programming he was under at the time of the assassination. I know it sounds very far-fetched, but this is actually stuff that he has reenacted in the last 5 years for Dr. Daniel Brown in the California prison system. So it's obviously there in his psyche, even kind of 40-odd years later, and was put down in a declaration in support of his habeas corpus petition that his attorneys had petitioned the courts with in the last 5 or 6 years, and also was put before the parole board both back in 2011, and there was a new declaration submitted to the parole board last week.
There is no question that Sirhan did attempt to assassinate Bobby Kennedy, that he was there in the pantry, that he fired quite a few shots, and the question is whether there was a second shooter.
Yeah, I mean, we know that Sirhan was there. We know he's fired his gun 8 times. But, you know, in terms of a second gun being there, the strongest evidence to that is something called the Brzezinski recording, which was is the only known audio recording of the shooting that night. It's been kind of lying in the California State Archives, kind of undiscovered for many years, and then a former CNN senior writer, Brad Johnson, discovered it in 2004. He got in touch with a forensic audio expert called Phil Van Praag, who did a very detailed analysis over it for several months, and came up with some very key discoveries of what that recording contained. The first was that there were 13 shot sounds, and the key portion of the recording when the shooting was actually taking place. Then when he analyzed them in more detail, he found 2 double shot intervals, which means that basically there were 2 shots so close together that they couldn't have come from the same gun, because any kind of even the best shooter just couldn't have fired 2 shots as quickly as is evident on the tape from a gun, which is one indication of a second gun. And also through various frequency anomalies for those particular 13 shot sounds, he was able to separate how many came from Sirhan's gun and how many came from a second gun, and the fact that those 2 different guns were firing in opposite directions. So if we put all this together, we see that 8 of the shots, according to the frequency anomaly analysis, 8 of the shots could be put down to Sirhan's gun, which is firing several feet in front of Kennedy, and 5 shots were fired from behind Kennedy in the opposite direction up towards Sirhan, and 5 of them came from behind Kennedy, including the 4 that shot him, including the fatal shot 1 inch behind the right ear. So it's kind of an astonishing piece of work that Phil Van Praag has been doing on that, and this is our strongest evidence, I feel, that there were 2 guns in the pantry, that 13 shots were fired, and that Sirhan in all likelihood missed Kennedy, and that the fatal shot came from the second shooter behind.
Talk a little bit about the ballistic evidence in the pantry, the number of shots, the number of people that were hit, bullets that were found in the damage that was found in the pantry, and the LAPD investigation into this.
Well, again, Paul Schrade kind of holds the key to that in a sense, because he was walking 6 to 8 feet behind Robert Kennedy through the pantry when the shooting started. And all the evidence suggests that Paul Schrade was actually the first person hit, probably by one of Sirhan's bullets. Because one of the witnesses who was right next to Sirhan and kind of between Paul Schrade and Sirhan at the time, he saw Paul Schrade fall first, and then he saw Senator Kennedy fall after that. And the fatal shot that hit Kennedy hit him from an inch behind his right ear. So once he was hit with that fatal shot, he would have collapsed to the floor. There's no doubt about that. So basically all the indications are that Paul Schrade was hit first, then Kennedy fell, and then there were several other people injured in the crossfire. So if we look at how the LAPD criminalist Duane Wolfer accounted for the 8 shots from Sirhan's gun, one key error that he made was that the bullet that hit Paul Schrade, according to Wolfer, went through the suit coat of Kennedy and went up through the lining without entering Kennedy's body and hit Paul Schrade in the head. So he had a very tight accounting of the bullets. Wolfer had a problem because there were 4 bullets fired at Kennedy. 3 hit his body, 1 went through his suit coat, and 5 others were injured. So in essence, there were a potential 9 shots that had to be accounted for with 8 bullets from Sirhan's gun. So how was he going to do that? So the magic bullet in this case, if you like, was the one that was fired at a sharp upward angle through Kennedy's suit jacket without entering his body, going through the shoulder pad of his coat, and then, according to Wolfer, hitting Paul Schrade in the head. Now, as I've already said, Schrade was walking 6 to 8 feet behind Kennedy through the pantry. So for that bullet to go through the shoulder pad of Kennedy's jacket and hit him in the head, as he said himself, he'd have to be 9 feet tall or literally sitting on Kennedy's shoulder when the shooting happened. It's just absurd. So one of the benefits of the LAPD files being released in 88 is we could see some of the creative accounting that LAPD were doing in the case to basically make the evidence fit their version of the crime. And you can see that there was very little margin for error. On top of that, we have FBI agent William Bailey, who was in the pantry a couple of hours after the shooting and saw 2 bullets being taken out of a center divider in the pantry doorframe. This center divider of the pantry doorframe was basically the door that Kennedy had come through when he'd come off the stage and walked into the pantry. So, you know, probably these bullets came from Sirhan's gun because he was firing in that direction as Kennedy was walking towards him. And all the evidence is that he missed Kennedy with those bullets and they injured bystanders instead. So if we look at that accounting, then we've got 2 bullets in the pantry center divider of the pantry doorframe. We've got 8 bullets from Sirhan's gun. We've got a rogue bullet that's not accounted for because Wolfer's accounting of the one that went through Kennedy's suit coat and hit Schrade doesn't make any sense. So we're already up to possibly 11 bullets there. So you can see that when we put that together with the Brzezinski recording and the 13 shot sounds that Phil Van Praeg found on the recording, at a very early stage, LAPD had some indication of the nature of the damage, that it was more than just Sirhan's gun, and they just, you know, they refused to admit that or to really follow it up in any kind of any proper way. There was an indication with Sandra Serrano that there was a girl in the polka dot dress with Sirhan in the pantry. She was seen by Vincent DiPiero with Sirhan in the pantry during the shooting. She was seen fleeing down a fire escape by Sandra Serrano after the shooting. But again, LAPD just tried to shut that down, that side of the investigation, and stick to the lone gunman theory throughout.
There is video that exists of the chaos that took place in the pantry. Talk a little bit about that and whether that video has been revealing in any way.
Well, I think it's in a sense it's been misleading because people get the sense that, you know, oh, I saw Bobby Kennedy being killed live on television, you know, because they've seen the chaos in the pantry and they assume that this was when the shooting was taking place. And the nature of television documentaries is sometimes they put fake gunshots on the footage just to kind of jazz it up. But it really, I mean, it doesn't tell us very much other than that, you know, I think the police later said there were up to 77 people in that pantry in a very low ceiling, small confined space. So I guess what it does tell us is that if there was a second gunman in there, literally at contact distance from Kennedy or just with a gun an inch behind his right ear, it would be very difficult to see who it was if it was a professional and it was a professional hitman, and they were able to, you know, at a sharp or upward angle, do the damage from a concealed kind of gun, and then be kind of spirited out of the pantry without anybody really seeing in the confusion what was going on. And obviously Sirhan drawing all the attention because he was out there waving his gun. Everybody went to try and restrain him and bang his gun on the steam table. The maitre d', Carl Euchre, who was leading Kennedy through the pantry, insisted that after two shots, Sirhan's gun was now diverted from Kennedy. So he was firing wildly down through the pantry and hit some of the other bystanders, and probably, you know, possibly the bullets in the centre divider would be from Sirhan's gun. So really, it was a very frenzied situation where it would be no surprise if a professional hitman were able to escape quite easily, and, you know, basically without kind of leaving any trace at the time.
I mean, I guess the question is, just as there has been computer analysis of the sound that was found, whether or not computer enhancement, computer analysis of the video might be more revealing today, 48 years later.
Yeah, you know, well, I mean, obviously this is the kind of $64 question. You know, it would be great if the video was revealing, but I don't think it's of sufficient resolution or sufficiently well lit to really give us very much. I think obviously if we found another audio recording of the gunshots that would further corroborate the findings of Van Praagh on the Pazinski recording, that would be very helpful. And even, you know, just rereading the autopsy report today, you know, if it was possible to look at some of the fragments of the bullet that penetrated Kennedy's brain, you know, that this bullet basically mushroomed and fragmented into many, many different tiny pieces. If it was possible to kind of establish what was the caliber of bullet and what was the make of bullet and so on, possibly that might be of some help. But it's very, very difficult. You know, there's a finite amount that we can do at this stage, I think, and we have to accept that.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about Paul Schrade and all those that want to see this case reopened and really have shown up at the various parole hearings for Sirhan.
Well, yeah, part of the project that I've just been doing is actually releasing the history of all of the transcripts of Sirhan's parole hearings dating back to the mid-70s. And really, nobody's shown up for the parole hearings. They've been kind of, well, people have been asking for a new investigation. They've kind of, I guess, including myself, we've kind of ignored the parole hearing process and what information it can give us about the case. So now all of those parole hearing transcripts are online, and you can go back and browse them at your leisure. So really, this is the first time William Wiesel, one of the shooting victims, went to the last parole hearing in 2011, and he told them that, you know, I was one of the shooting victims on the night, and I'm told Sirhan has been making a lot of progress in prison, and I would have no problem if you judged him eligible for parole. But the parole boards ignored him, and they denied Sirhan again in 2011. But now Paul Schrade, I think, has taken it up a level by appearing at this year's hearing, because here we have a very close friend of Bobby Kennedy, who was his Labour chair in 68 and campaigned for him solidly throughout California. He was actually on stage with Bobby Kennedy and publicly thanked during the victory speech just minutes before Bobby Kennedy was shot. Of course, he was shot himself in the head, and, you know, just millimeters either way, and maybe he would have been killed as well. So it says a lot if he feels so strongly about reopening the case and about Sirhan's innocence, that he comes to the parole hearing, and by all accounts, gave a fairly blistering performance in terms of telling the parole boards the facts of the case, the way they need to be looked at again, and you know, how it might affect Sirhan's parole. So, you know, I think it's very, very significant that he was there. And also, we have evidence now that perhaps some members of the Kennedy family are beginning to share the same view, because one of the documents that Paul Schrade brought to the parole board last week was a letter from Bobby Kennedy Jr. Asking the Attorney General, Eric Holder, back in 2012, mm-hmm. to support Paul's efforts to reopen the case. And as far as I can determine, that support is still there from Bobby Kennedy Jr., that he would like to support Paul Schrade's efforts to get his father's case reinvestigated by now the LA County District Attorney. So that's the next phase of our efforts after Sirhan's latest denial.
And is it your sense that even if the case were to be reopened at this point, that there would be anything conclusive from that effort that would lead to really any kind of revelation that's different than what's out there now?
Well, I think obviously it opens up a very big can of worms, because there's no guarantee that we can find who done it. You know, there's no guarantee that we can find who programmed Sirhan, who the second shooter was. But we can, in a limited sense, establish that, you know, Sirhan should never have been convicted of first degree murder, because he probably didn't fire the fatal shot that killed Bobby Kennedy. He certainly wasn't in any mental state to take full responsibility for the crime. All the indications are from the psychiatrist who worked with him most closely over the years that, you know, he was in a hypnotic state at the time. Whether that was a state of self-hypnosis or whether there were third parties involved, he certainly shouldn't have been convicted of first-degree murder at the time. And even his first-degree murder conviction made him eligible for parole in the early 80s. And then he was actually due for release in 1984 until a political campaign in California basically led to that parole date being rescinded. So I think at a minimum, we can say that Sirhan should no longer be in prison. And he's been really kept as a political prisoner because there isn't a political will to reinvestigate the case and say, well, if Sirhan wasn't guilty and there was somebody else, even if we can't find that somebody else, we have to give Sirhan the full weight of the law in terms of, you know, applying it to his case and letting him serve out the last years of his life as a free man. So even if we can't tie up the case and find out who did everything, that, you know, the justice system should give him due process in terms of looking at his individual responsibility and reinvestigating the others who may have been involved.
Shane O'Sullivan, I thank you so much for spending time with us today on Radio Who, What, Why.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you'll join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share it and help other people find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.